Iran says the outcome of the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA hinges upon a political decision by the United States. Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank amid tensions in the Flashpoint neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. And Bahrain's top Shiite cleric and the main opposition group, Al-Wafaq, condemned the appointment of a naval Israeli officer to be stationed in the country. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Iran's top security official says that the fate of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA has come down to a political decision by Washington, obviating the need for speculations. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said that the negotiations have reached a stage that does not require guesswork, and the result can be definitively declared. He said that the U.S. must decide whether it will embrace or refuse to accept the requirements for a reliable and durable agreement based on principles agreed to in the JCPOA. But the comments came as Iran and the remaining parties to the accord are engaged in diplomatic efforts in Vienna to restore the deal that was battered by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman also says that the country is awaiting a political decision by the Western side.
Currently going on in Vienna are discussions about very important, sensitive, outstanding issues. This is no secret to anyone. What remains is to reach a point where political decisions should be made. Tehran has already made its political decisions years ago and remained inside the JCPOA. Iran is now waiting to receive the response to its initiatives from the Western side in particular.
The spokesman said that currently there is no deadlock in the talks and negotiations will inevitably slow down as more serious issues are discussed and tougher decisions are needed. The spokesman has stressed that there is an inverse correlation between the will and resolve of the Western side and the time required to reach an agreement. Said Khatibzadeh says that all anti-Iran sanctions at odds with the JCPOA and Resolution 2231, which enshrines the deal, must be removed regardless of the label under which they've been imposed. Omal Ezgi is following the developments regarding the talks between Iran and the signatories to the JCPOA in Vienna. She explains how even some of the U.S. allies are becoming agitated at its failure to come to a decision.
Some sources have been saying or claiming that the Russians and the Chinese and even the Europeans are quite frustrated with the fact that the American team is not giving a firm response to these proposals or coming up with the decision that it needs to come up with. And this is seen as a sign of differences within the U.S. negotiating team itself, or also, of course, the pressure that the Biden administration faces from Republicans, from allies like Israel, etc. So these are all, of course, playing into the issue. What the Iranian sources say is that they are not here, as some Western media sources may claim, to prolong the negotiations, to drag things. They believe that an agreement is within sight. The Western side has said that they believe and a conclusion to these talks is also possible and within sight if the necessary decisions are made. The sticking points, of course, we know specifically on the scope of sanctions and the issue of verification and guarantees.
A fire is reportedly broken out at a support base of the Iranian armed forces in the western province of Kermanshah. Reports said a fire that's now contained was limited to a stock room for engine oil and other inflammable material. No one was hurt in the incident at the base belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. An investigation is going on to determine the damage and the cause of the fire. The Palestinian Prisoner Association has announced a comprehensive strike in all Israeli jails amid new controversy over the Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The call for a strike comes amid confrontation between regime forces and Palestinian protesters over the planned eviction of resident families and demolition of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Protests erupted on Sunday after a far-right Israeli lawmaker visited the area and opened a parliamentary office there. 30 Palestinians got injured after Israeli forces and extremist settlers attacked the protest. Regime forces remain heavily deployed to the neighborhood. Meantime, hundreds held a funeral procession in the northern West Bank for a Palestinian teenager who was shot dead by Israeli forces. The 17-year-old was shot in the head during a protest against the Israeli destruction of a Palestinian house. Protesters initially managed to prevent the demolition in the town of Jenin, but regime forces returned to the area and razed the structure overnight. Israel frequently destroys the homes of Palestinians allegedly involved in attacks on settlers, and that's beside separate destructions under the regime's settlement expansion policies. A short while ago, we're joined by correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil, provided some details regarding the Israeli violence in Jenin and Al-Quds.
What happened is that Israeli forces with their armored vehicles and jeeps, tanks, raided the village of Silat al-Harithiya in order to destroy the home of a Palestinian prisoner, this Palestinian prisoner, Mohammed Jaradat, whom the Israeli authorities accuse that he carried out a shooting attack against Israeli settlers. The Israeli troops were intending to destroy his home. Clashes erupted between the Palestinians living in the village of Silat al-Harithiya and other villages around this town with the Israeli forces. They retreated back. However, in the early hours of this morning, Israeli troops returned to the village of Silat al-Harithiya and succeeded, unfortunately, to destroy the home of Jaradat, this Palestinian prisoner. Elsewhere in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, the situation is still tense, with Palestinians are still protesting the settlers' attacks, settlers' aggression, and they clash together, the settlers and the residents of Sheikh Jarrah, and even the protesters who had been there. A number of Palestinians were wounded because at the end of the day, of course, Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians, protecting and giving the support to the Israeli settlers in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, Bahrain's top cleric has called on all Muslims to stand against any compromise with the Tel Aviv regime and its expansionism. Sheikh Isa Qasim says the Muslim community has the responsibility to oppose Israel's oppressive policies. He slammed the deployment of a senior Israeli officer to Bahrain as another sign of Israeli colonialist measure. On Saturday, Manamak confirmed the stationing of a ranking Israeli officer in Bahrain as part of an international coalition. The move was also criticized by main opposition group Al-Wafaq. It says that the ruling Al-Khalifa regime's decision for such an appointment was an attack on Bahraini sovereignty. Al-Wafaq also questioned the popular legitimacy of the Bahraini regime, saying the Al-Khalifa is on a quest to obtain a, quote, fictitious power from the Zionists. As Bahrain's popular uprising enters its 13th year, the country's top Shia cleric is calling on the nation to stand united in their fight against oppression. We've discussed that issue at length in our news review program.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in that country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there cannot be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. People demanded equality and freedom. The regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. Despite that, pro-democracy protests have continued. Joining me in this edition of News Review are Tim Anderson, he is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Sydney, and Zafar Bangish, he is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in this edition of News Review. Let me first start with Zafar Bangish in Toronto. Today is the anniversary of the popular uprising in Bahrain that began in 2011. And despite its harsh repressive measures, the Manama regime has not been able to contain the uprising. I want to ask you this. What's the future outlook for the uprising in Bahrain?
Well, as you mentioned, March 14th marks the 11th anniversary of the People's Uprising. And the fact that the people have not given up, even after 11 years of extreme oppression, first through the Saudi military forces invading Bahrain to crush the uprising, the regime itself destroying the Pearl Roundabout or the Pearl Square in Manama, and yet the people's resolve to secure their rights have not been dampened. They continue to struggle for their rights. So in that sense, and obviously they are the majority of the people in Bahrain. And as Sheikh Isa Qasim pointed out, if the people remain united, there's a new constitution that guarantees the rights of all the people. Definitely, victory will ultimately be that of the Bahraini people through their uprising and just struggle.
Let me cross over then in Sydney. The Bahraini regime has been trying to control the popular uprising with an iron fist, killing hundreds, jailing thousands, yet it hasn't been successful. And at the same time, the international community has been silent toward the aggression, toward the crimes that the regime has been committing. Why is this happening?
Because the so-called international community, by which typically they mean Western states and their passive populations, have been fed misinformation about the entire region. The most democratic of the Arab states were crushed in the name of a color revolution, and the actual revolutions of the region, the democracy uprising in Bahrain, the genuine revolution of 2014-15 in Yemen, are brutally crushed. And the propaganda follows those lines, basically. It's utter confusion when it comes to reporting in the Western world of Yemen and Bahrain. The only two, in the case of Yemen, the real revolution, and in Bahrain, the incipient revolution, which was crushed, as you've already said, by the Manama regime, backed by the Saudis, which the Western countries all arm and help carry out their dirty work.
Right. Mr. Bangesh, we know that Bahrain is a close ally to the U.S., and it actually hosts the U.S.'s Fifth Fleet. And the U.S. claims to be an advocate of human rights, but it hasn't done anything to stop the Al Khalifa regime from committing these crimes, and it hasn't done anything to make the regime change the way it treats dissidents. Why?
Well, basically, America's claim to being a democracy and champion of human rights is a complete fraud. I mean, you know, Guantanamo Bay, for instance, there are still at least 40 prisoners languishing, the vast majority of them completely innocent. You remember that back in 2002, when the torture chamber was opened in Guantanamo Bay, the Americans brought 700 prisoners over there, and they called them the worst of the worst. And we know the vast majority, I mean, that's almost 660 of them, have already been released because there were no charges, nothing against them. And also in the United States itself, we know that it oppresses its own black population. It has a horrible history of slaughtering the indigenous people. The U.S. in the last 20 years has committed horrific crimes that has killed millions of people all around the world, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, the list goes on. So I think the U.S. regime is in no position to claim that it stands for human rights or human dignity or democracy. And that also explains the reason why it is supporting the dictatorship in Bahrain, because the U.S. has the Fifth Fleet over there, and the U.S. knows that if a genuine popular revolution takes place in Bahrain, then obviously the people of Bahrain would not allow a U.S. military base to be continue to exist over there. So these are some of the reasons why the U.S. claims to being the human rights champion or defender are utterly false.
Thank you so much. Tim Anderson, let's take a look at the demands that protesters have here. They want a peaceful, democratic transition in their country, and they want a constitution that represents all groups of people. Why are they then being treated so brutally? What is it about their demands that sends fear down the spine of the Al Khalifa regime?
Well, the regime, of course, has no interest in democracy or human rights, as your guest said, nor does the U.S. The Bahrain, like Qatar, hosts a huge military base, a naval base in the case of Bahrain, and that's what it serves the purpose of the US there. Of course, what Sheikh Qassem said about a new constitution is a very important thing and should be focused on, because if there is to be a democracy brought to some of these petromonarchies of the Persian Gulf, it has to be founded on some new writing of the law, new popular consensus about the foundation of those societies. So the idea of a new constitution, of course, is anathema to it's horrifies the Manama regime, and it horrifies Washington too. Washington has no interest in democracy or human rights in any of those states which serve its purposes in the region, which is a failing project to dominate the entire region.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on this edition of News Review. I've been talking to Tim Anderson. He is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, who joined us from Sydney. And Zafar Bangesh, she is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joined us from Toronto.
Saudi warplanes have performed air raids on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, targeting a communication system near the telecoms ministry. According to Yemeni sources, the strike destroyed the Tele-Yemen Telecoms Company building and damaged a neighboring building. Riyadh claims that the ministry is being used by Yemeni forces to control drones targeting Saudi positions. The coalition earlier asked civilians and the ministries in Sana'a to immediately evacuate. Last week, Yemeni forces said that they had hit a military target at the Saudi Apa International Airport with a drone. The Yemeni army, backed by popular forces, has intensified attacks in response to the ongoing Saudi-led war and blockade, which have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Basically, materialistic powers are intimidated by the word revolution. They are afraid of it, intimidated by it, and panic at the mention of the word Islamic revolution. So they have a reason for being afraid. Nonetheless, pressures are exerted with various excuses by the enemies. Sometimes they exert pressure while using the excuse of the nuclear issue. Sometimes they increase the pressure on Iran with the excuse of human rights and the like. But the truth of the matter is that the enemies of the Iranian people and of Islamic Iran are intimidated by and worried over the qualities that come with being a revolutionary. Lately, in recent months, an American politician said, sanctions are imposed on Iran because of the Islamic Revolution. The sense of sanctions originates from the revolution that was launched in 1979, the revolution of the year 1357. This is the reality.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the reason, and why are they opposed to the revolution? The reason is that this great, vast, blessed, and rich country that enjoys both natural and human resources of wealth was completely cut up in their claws at once. It used to be under America's control, but the revolution took over and tossed them out. Their animosity towards the Islamic Revolution is owed to this fact. The revolution sent them away. Furthermore, it inspired others around the world too. The Islamic Revolution, which was launched and pursued by the people of Iran, became an inspiration for other nations. This issue requires a detailed discussion, and there are countless reasons for that. Our revolutionary Imam, rahmatullah alayh, pulled the country out of various quagmires. He pulled the country out of various morasses with the help of the Islamic Revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss India's Nagaland, in which there is no war, but no peace either. And the eyes of Afghanistan on U.S. aid, while it has no access to its own assets abroad, mainly in the U.S.
Nagaland is an extremely remote state in northeastern India. It's surrounded by Arunachal Pradesh in the northeast, Manipur in the south, Assam in the west and northwest. There are some 50 million people living in this area, which is connected to the country through a tiny corridor called Siliguri. The area is geopolitically important to India too. It forms the country's borders with Bangladesh, Myanmar, Bhutan and China. Thus, New Delhi puts emphasis on maintaining security in the area, especially Nagaland, at any cost.
Nagaland is a northeastern Indian state. It is one of the seven states separated from mainland India, and Siliguri is the narrow corridor that connects the area to the rest of the country. Nagaland is home to over 2.2 million people, the majority of them Baptist Christian and English-speaking. Economically, agriculture is the most important activity, which accounts for some 70% of the state's economy. In 1947, shortly before India's independence from Britain, tribes in the state became united and formed the Naga National Council. In 1951, a referendum for independence of the state was held, and 99% of Nagas voted for independence. However, central government rejected the vote, and guerrilla warfare broke out, and armed violence escalated since then. The Indian government and Nagas held the first peace talk in 1975. None of the dozens of peace talks in four decades led to a lasting peace, though. Still, they managed to bring down the level of violence. Nagas agreed to bury the hatchet, gave up their struggle for full independence, and accepted the Indian constitution. Dialogue resulted in an agreement signed in August 2015 between Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the state officials. It was regarded as a major breakthrough which could encourage the Naga groups to give up their arms.
Religion, language, and culture make the residents of Nagaland different from the rest of the country. New Delhi views the state as a veiled threat, especially after dozens of peace talks in decades did not produce a concrete result. An uprising in Nagaland remains a main concern for New Delhi, which knows that a minor incident in this region can trigger a national security disaster. Let's see how the central government is doing in this region.
On December the 4th last year, the killing of 13 civilians by the Indian Army hit the headlines. Local media reported that security forces opened fire on Nagas close to the border with Myanmar. The Indian Army issued a statement saying it had expected a movement of insurgents. Apparently, the forces mistook the civilians for insurgents. Nagas took to the streets in various districts, but the army yet again shot dead another civilian. It sparked region-wide protests in which the local leaders joined thousands of protesters. They demanded justice be served and a rollback of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, AFSPA. Under this act, which was passed into law in 1958, the Indian Army can search, arrest and even shoot suspects. But federal approval is a prerequisite for prosecution by civilian courts. Human rights groups say the army abuses the law, which makes many areas feel like occupied territory. The December tragedy made the state's officials fiercely dispute AFSPA. Nagaland's assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding the repeal of AFSPA, and the state's chief minister, Nipi Rio, said his government wanted to do away with it. Their efforts were in vain as the act was extended by the federal government. Naga officials fear this could impede future peace talks and there would be results. Nagas who seek sovereignty or more autonomy experience no war anymore in their land, but no peace either.
Now we are joined by Dr. Saurabh Bhattacharjee, Associate Professor at National Law School of India, to further discuss the affairs in Nagaland. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. How do you view the peacemaking efforts taking place between Nagaland and the Indian government, and why is peace so fragile in this area?
Hello. The peace process has gone on between the Naga groups and Indian government for more than two decades now. And it is at a critical juncture at this moment because there seems to have been a deadlock between the government and the insurgents. Also, the nationalist government's hardline stance has in some ways reduced the scope for negotiation and compromise between the two sides. The situation in Burma may also lead to further instability in Nagaland and other adjacent districts. And the larger political crisis that the government is facing at this moment may actually reduce its options. So I think now it's at a very critical juncture with the direction over the next few years will tell us whether the peace process is going to end up in some sort of a success or whether it will end up as a failure.
So Dr. Bhattacharjee, what is your assessment of New Delhi's security policies in Nagaland?
Army's presence in Nagaland has had a prolonged impact on the fate of peace process, as well as the integration of Naga civil society and the community within the national mainstream. Army was introduced sometime in 1950s as a short-term measure to combat insurgency. And it's been 7 decades since then that army has remained in Nagaland. And that speaks of the failure of using army as a political tool when perhaps dialogue and negotiation might be more successful. Secondly, several commentators and Naga civil society groups have very persuasively argued that the level of violence in Nagaland has been very low since the ceasefire, despite few irritants, despite few incidents here and there. The level of violence that we see in Nagaland is much lower than what we see in some of the other Indian states. And yet we have kept army in Nagaland, and that reflects very poorly on the democratic rights of the citizens. And militarization in any manner is incompatible with principles of democracy, is incompatible with principles of liberty. And as citizens, they have a legitimate right to ask for demilitarization. And additionally, I must also emphasize on the fact that Armed Forces Special Powers Act provides army complete impunity, and no case can be filed against any army personnel for any human rights abuse, for any crime otherwise in connection with counterinsurgency operations without the permission of the central government. And that has been seen as a major bone of contention and is a major denial of right to life and liberty for Naga citizens. And from that angle, one must say that the removal of army is an immediate need to ensure that peace forces can move forward.
Dr. Bhattacharjee, do you see any grounds for optimism for the current status of Nagaland?
The special status does provide some rights to Naga state government as well as the civil society organization, some space. But at the same time, if you follow the demands that have come from NSCIN, which is the armed group that is having dialogue with the government of India, one can see that there has been a constant demand for recognition of the unique culture and history of Naga community. And it's also been a demand for separate state constitution, a separate flag for their state, and for integration of other Naga areas with Nagaland in adjacent states. So that's something that is still very much within the concerns of Naga civil society groups. Additionally, Naga groups have also asked for removal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act and gradual demilitarization. And that is something that is required to be done before peace process can move forward in any effective manner. So from that angle, I think the current status that they have is not something that would satisfy most groups. In fact, the current status was put in place after a peace accord in 1975. But clearly that did not result in a long-lasting peace within Nagaland or within other Naga groups.
So how would you think the neighboring Indian states are affected by the affairs in Nagaland?
That's the trickiest part of the Naga peace process, because on one hand, there are some common concerns about autonomy, common concerns about recognition of cultural and historical rights of various states. So there has been an armed struggle in Assam for more than 4 decades. Mizoram, another state, saw very violent insurgency for more than 2 decades. Manipur also has a serious crisis of armed insurgency. So from that angle, I think there are a few commonalities that do apply between other states. And I think the longer history of Northeast tells us that there is a concern with respect to integration of these states within the national mainstream, and at the same time recognition of their autonomy, unique history, as well as recognition of their cultural rights and demographic identity. But on the other hand, the peace process also revolves around unification of all the Naga areas, and a large part of the claim that NSCIN, the armed group which is in negotiation with the government of India, has is around adjacent areas from other states, including Assam, Arunachal Pradesh, Manipur, and they want all those areas to be integrated with Nagaland, and they call for a greater Nagalim. And that is something that is politically very explosive, because other states don't want to give up their territory. There has been also armed clashes between police of all the states. So it's not just a fight between the armed insurgents and the government of India. There have also been clashes between armed police of all the states. So given that history, I think it's a very paradoxical position with respect to the relation between the Nagar peace process and the history of other states. There are commonalities and very acute differences that may make the peace process very violent and can have also very catastrophic impact on the relation between Nagaland and other neighboring states.
Dr. Bhattacharya, thank you for being on the subcontinent. Now, let's take a look at people's reaction on this issue on social media network.
An Indian rights group based in Germany says laws like AFSPA are used to criminalize political agency of minorities in India. A columnist, social activist and academic says the December killing in Nagaland has made the repeal of AFSPA a pledge in election campaigns in the neighboring Manipur state. Anil Jha is a social activist who hopes Indians will soon witness the repeal of AFSPA, especially after Nagaland issues.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The world's eyes are on Afghans who are facing a freezing cold winter. Nationwide poverty caused by the collapsed economy is significant in the country. The UN's assessment says $8.8 billion are needed to build back the country. However, $4.4 billion of that are for the vital needs. In this dire situation, Afghans are fed with tiny international aid, such as the recent US aid of $308 million. This is while Washington has frozen Afghans' assets, nearly $10 billion in its banks.
The mainstream media is buzzing that the U.S. is offering a new sum in aid of $308 million to Afghans on humanitarian grounds. The White House says the aid will be handed to what it called independent humanitarian organizations. Washington says the aid aims to provide nations with shelter and food. The aid comes as the U.S. war-torn Afghanistan is coming closer to humanitarian crisis. The UN says in its 2022 response plan for Afghanistan that the country needs $4.4 billion to meet life-saving needs. It also estimates another $3.6 billion are needed for essential social services, including education and health. Following the takeover of Kabul by the Taliban last August, international funding to Afghanistan was suspended. Meanwhile, the country's foreign assets of billions of US dollars were frozen, mainly by Washington. This move meant an economic collapse for Afghanistan, as some 80% of the previous government's budget would come from the international community. The lack of funding has affected hospitals, schools, factories, and government ministries. The government employees, ranging from laborers to university professors, haven't been paid in months. On the other hand, the banks have limited the amount of money clients can withdraw. Hence, the nation is caught in a poverty trap.
The story of Afghanistan and the U.S. traces its roots back to the Afghans' war with the Soviet Union when the CIA created, armed and trained the militia in the region. Afghanistan today is a full-length portrait of the U.S.'s intervention. Decades of wars have had no concrete result, as it was the case in the last war. The U.S. started the fight with the Taliban in 2001 and the war ended with the Taliban retaking the country last year.
The U.S.'s seizure of Afghanistan's assets when Kabul is desperate is only one among many moves Washington has made. In fact, the U.S. has a long history of like moves. Waging war on the country and political interference in domestic affairs were the most significant among them. The United States' war on Afghanistan followed the September 11 incident in 2001. There were many ups and downs in the war's 20-year-long lifeline. It was also expanded to tribal areas in neighboring Pakistan. As Brown University estimated in April 2021, about 241,000 people were killed since 2001 in the Afghanistan and Pakistan war zone. Over 71,000 of the casualties were civilians. It was also estimated Washington spent some $2.26 trillion of Americans' tax in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Washington made considerable efforts to make Afghanistan strongly depend on the U.S. It backed certain people who would run pro-U.S. policies in the country's political structure. In the last few years of the war, Washington held direct peace talks with the Taliban, while no representatives from Kabul were allowed into the sessions. In 2021, the world witnessed the U.S.'s chaotic withdrawal of its forces from Afghanistan. Amid the pullout, Kabul rapidly collapsed. The Taliban were ruling Afghanistan when the U.S. first waged its war, and the war ended with the Taliban retaking the country.
Now, Mr. Subir Bhowmick, author and former BBC correspondent, is now joining us to provide more insight into the hidden side of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhowmick. Now, how do you view the U.S. aid flow in Afghanistan, and how could we know that the total aid is fully delivered to the Afghans and not spent elsewhere?
Hello, I'm Subir Bhowmick from India, and the answer to your question is, we really don't know why the U.S. is not going through the U.N. system. Because my country, India, is also sending a lot of humanitarian aid. We're sending 50 million tons of wheat to begin with to the Afghan people. And this will go through Pakistan. We have not had the best of relations with Pakistan, but on this issue, India and Pakistan has come together, and Pakistan is allowing transportation through its territory, 50 million tons of wheat for the Afghan people who are in all kinds of trouble. The thing is, there is an UN system, and the US apparently, you know, uses the UN system when it suits them more than anybody else in the world. But why this aid is not routed through the UN system is a million-dollar question. Why is it directly going to the Afghan government, which it does not recognize? You know, that's a whole big issue, actually. So it serves everybody's purpose if this aid is routed through the UN system, because then there is some kind of coordination and linkage between what the Afghan peoples want most and what they want somewhat less, and, you know, what is being sent to them. You know, the whole international aid effort for Afghanistan can be much better coordinated if it is routed through the UN system rather than bilaterally. The other point I would imagine is that when the Americans give any aid, you know, it's generally sort of in the interest of their own companies. So we have to explore whether there's a corporate angle to this whole thing. You know, whether the Americans are trying to send out some of their own surplus stuff, which does not have a market elsewhere, you know, in the world, to Afghanistan in the name of aid. That's something we need to figure out.
So, Mr. Bhowmick, how do you see the U.S. aid, and are they really aimed to address the fundamental needs of the nation?
No, we really don't know what the U.S. is going to send. If it's just giving money, you know, dollars, it's a bit of a contradiction, Mr. Jaffer, isn't it, that the U.S. is blocking Afghanistan's sort of bona fide foreign reserves, which are held in their country. You know, they're trying to block it for all kinds of reasons that they're forwarding. And now they're saying if they send, you know, cash aid, aid in terms of funds rather than material, then that's an issue. Secondly, if they're sending some material, you know, wheat or you know, whatever, food stuff or whatever else, then it's better sent through the United Nations, because then it's all coordinated. Otherwise, there is a possibility of duplication or replication. Let's say if the Indians also send wheat and the Americans also send wheat, then there is too much wheat and too little of other things that the Afghan people need. So maybe if the Indians are sending wheat, the Americans can send medicine. But this is better coordinated if it is done through the UN system. It's quite obvious.
So for helping out, why doesn't Washington release Afghanistan's central bank assets in the American banks?
Well, I don't really believe, that the U.S. is trying to do all this to ease the suffering of the Afghan people. The U.S. is always caught in the dilemma of, pursuing their big power interests, which they define very widely, often to the detriment of the national interests of other countries. And also, trying to sort of harmonize it with the humanitarian considerations that one expects of a democracy. So the U.S. is always caught in this kind of a dilemma. But here I would imagine that the U.S. there is a lot of optics involved, that the U.S. is trying to send humanitarian aid to a country which needs it, and where a lot of problems that the country now faces is because of the conflict in which the U.S. was embroiled directly. Yeah, first in backing the Mujahideen effort against the Soviet Union, and then sort of fight against terror. But the point here is one needs to figure out is whether the U.S. is doing it for humanitarian consideration, or whether it is trying to regain some kind of a diplomatic presence in Afghanistan, which is not available to them at the moment since their military pullout. So that's more possible than pure humanitarian consideration.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Subir Bhowmick for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see what people have been saying on social media.
A social activist argues Washington's freezing foreign assets is robbing the nation's wealth. Rahmatullah is a senior planning and reporting specialist at UNESCO. He criticizes the situation despite the US aid and other international aids. An NGO says it is hypocrisy to claim $308 million in US aid will go to the people, as the US is seeking to retain presence through NGO networks.
And that was our episode covering India's Nagaland affairs and the US war on Afghans. We will meet again next week. Till then, take care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Noor Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. The pleasure is all mine. The question today is unfortunately a saying that we are starting to hear more and more and more of in our society. And for Muslims who live in developed countries, they hear this a lot. And or even in our own Islamic cottage, which we think are still fundamentally tied to Islam, this is a huge and growing issue. And so what is it that we normally hear? What is it that we sometimes may hear? Well, let me read it to you. One such saying of a person. This person says that the hijab does not matter at all. What matters is that your heart is pure. And they go on to say that many bad-mannered women wear the hijab. So there's no reason to wear the hijab. It's just a piece of cloth. Right, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for raising this beautiful question. Of course, as you said, it is one of the questions that frequently asked by different people. And the points here about the one of the misconception that is, as I said, prevailing among some people. They think that if you have pure heart, it is enough for you and no more action is needed in order to become, for example, a servant of Allah and become Abdul Saleh, righteous servant.
We've heard this excuse many times. No need to pray, no need to do fasting and all of that charity. No, it is your heart.
Yes.
Just dance around and then...
Yeah. You're right. It's frequently asked question, but the answer to this question is exactly vice versa. Because if you go to the narrations and to the verses of Noble Quran, you find what is matter is your righteous action. Okay?
Righteous action.
Righteous action and behavior that you have, which we call it Amalus Salih, is the most important and it gives the privilege for a person. Not only pure heart, of course, pure heart is needed. It is very nice. You need to have pure intention.
What is meant by pure? Is it a sincerity, a niyyah, a good niyyah?
In Farsi culture, when we say pure heart, yes.
So ikhlas, actually sincerity.
You kind of do not have evil intention towards people.
Okay.
Especially referring to this point, you do not have. You should not bother any person.
So you're a kind person.
Kind person.
Kind of what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is this matter. Of course, it has some roots in our culture. But anyway, these are important. All of them, they are factor for the religion. You should have pure heart. You should not bother and cause trouble for people. All of them, right? But the most important thing, actually, which embrace all of that, is al-amalu salih. Illa alladhina amanu wa amalu salihat. Those people who are faithful and who have righteous action.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
In many narration from Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salatu wasalam, they say that there is no relationship with us between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. لَيْسَ بَيْنَ اللَّهُ وَبَيْنَ خَلْقِهِ غَرَابَةً. Even we as Ahlul Bayt, it means that there is no relationship between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even we as Ahlul Bayt, if supposedly speaking, if we practice or commit sin, we go to hell. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is only looking at your, you know, action, looking at your treatment.
So the meaning is that, for example, just to again paint this in a worldly situation so we can understand it. For example, you are a student in a school and your father, he is perhaps the principal, right? And you make a mistake, you should be punished for it. But because your father is the principal, he doesn't punish you for it, right? So a kind of a nepotism.
Yes.
But this verse says, no, there's no such relationship with God. It is only your actions that matters.
Only your action. There is no nepotism, as you mentioned. Only the action is matters. Of course, this action, part of it is, you know, for example, the beginning of that is your impure intention and many other elements beside that. But generally speaking, yes, what matters is your action. Let me share one verse of Noble Quran. الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةِ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا. Who created the death and life, who created, in other verses, we have the heavens and earth.
Right.
In order to test you and in order to of course, become clear which person is best action and
yes,
best
amala,
practice.
Yes, the actions. So it isn't just about having a pure heart. It's the actions.
Of course. In many other, I can share it with you, my
Please
dear
do.
Listeners, talking about this verse. For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَتِلْكَ الْأَيَّامُ نُدَاوِلُهَا بَيْنَ النَّاسِ وَلِيَعْلَمَ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَيَتَّخِذَ مِنْكُمْ شُهَدَاءَ وَاللَّهُ لَا يُحِبُّ الظَّالِمِينَ These days are frequently passing among you in order for Allah to know. Of course, we explained what يَعْلَمَ اللَّهُ means, that whatever Allah knows to be, you know, implemented.
Right.
In order to become clear that which of you are faithful, and Allah takes some witnesses among you, and Allah does not like the transgressor. You see, at the end of the verse.
Again, a transgressor. So by understanding what a transgressor is, dear Sheikh, again, you reach the same conclusion. A transgressor is what exactly, dear Sheikh, just for our listeners to understand?
Yes, the transgressor means that person is not a righteous servant of Allah, and he has a lot of shortcoming in his or her actions.
In actions, again, actions and deeds.
Yes, of course. You see, it is very clear if you look at the verses of Noble Quran and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt and many other, you know, even rationally speaking, you understand that the only, you know, merely pure heart is not enough for a person
right.
to be a nice person and to be considered to be a, you know, righteous person.
That's a very good point, because we have many people who are perhaps ill-mannered, they behave in bad ways, but their intentions are pure. Their hearts are pure, they say themselves.
Actually, I personally believe that this is impossible. Because
yes.
If you have pure heart, from pure heart, what esteems from that is pure action.
Exactly.
If you do not have pure, if you have evil action, it is the indication that your heart is not pure.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
About the other point that the questioner asked about the, of course, it was a false accusation for those sisters who observed the hijab.
Yes.
I've seen many people who observe the hijab and they practice hijab, but and they have very good and sense of humor with people. They are respectful.
Yes,
you know,
dear Sheikh, this isn't an argument. We cannot accept this as an argument at all, because I can also say I've seen many women without hijab being bad-mannered, and I've seen many women without hijab being good-mannered as well.
Yes.
It is not just an anecdote. It is not a scientific evidence that we can use as an argument.
Yes, you're right. Maybe he or she has seen some people who observe.
Unfortunately,
maybe
yes.
On some occasion they have.
No, it is possible, Tisha, yeah. Because we have Muslims and mu'mineen and mu'minat, faithful people who look like faithful people, but do not have good manners. Again, yes, unfortunately, you have this problem. It shouldn't be this way, but that's how it is, unfortunately.
Yes, you're right. But the point that I want to add here for my dear listeners, brothers and sisters, we have in verses of Noble Quran, two verses at least, referring to the point, to the Islamic law of hijab.
Right.
So the hijab has been mentioned in the verses of Noble Quran. Let me share one verse, which is in chapter Nur, verse number 31.
Right.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that, قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ يَغْضُزْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِنَّ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُنَّ. Tell to the faithful woman to cast down the looks and to safeguard their private parts. وَلَا يُبْدِينَ ذِينَ